If everyone's ready, the next argued case is Appeal Number 21-1385, Ampersand Chowchilla Biomass against the United States. Mr. Leatham.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Leatham, and I am representing the two plaintiffs and appellants in this case, which we've been referring to as Chowchilla and Merced. This is a placed-in-service case. Placed-in-service cases are not uncommon, but the decision from the district court was very uncommon. The trial court concluded, let me restate that. No other placed-in-service case that we have found has reached a conclusion like the trial court did. Number one, that simply connecting to the grid and selling some electricity is enough to be placed in service. Number two, where required testing has not been passed or waived. And number three, where the facility's operations are illegal.
What about the Seeley case? I mean, I read the Seeley case, and I thought that the facts there seemed fairly analogous.
Well, the Seeley case, their environmental testing was waived. It was a prefab facility that did not require construction. And there they were focused on the quantity of power being produced. And here we're focused on very different things than the amount of power being produced, although that's part of it. The Seeley case is important for one reason, in our view. We think that the comment from Seeley, where it found that the tax court erred in interpreting the legal standards of defining when an asset is placed in service, led the Fifth Circuit to review the tax court's decision de novo. And there are several aspects of this case that we believe this court should also renew de novo, because the court erred on qualitative questions of law. And there are four of those. Number one, the trial court did not accept the taxpayer's definition or statement of what the specifically assigned function of the facilities was. The case law makes clear that it's for the taxpayer to decide what that function is. Here, the stated function was to produce baseload power legally and reliably. The court declared, in no uncertain terms, that the function of these facilities was simply to produce and sell some electricity. In other words, to connect to the grid. Every facility has to connect to the grid in order to conduct any testing that generates power.
Is your view that that is not a factual question, that it's a legal question?
I think that is a legal question.
Why? Because I'm pretty sure it's a factual question.
Well, in our view, it becomes a legal question because the court simply rejected the taxpayer's determination of what the function was. And the case law is that the taxpayer gets to make that determination. So we view that as a legal error.
Do I understand maybe you're saying that the court should have applied the wrong law, but it's still a factual question, but they have to apply the correct law?
Yes, that's a fair way to put it. Thank you.
Okay.
Saying that that connecting to the grid and producing some power is sufficient for placing service was specifically rejected in the Oglethorpe and Consumers case, and they noted that the IRS has never even gone so far as to say that connecting and producing power equals placed in service. This court went where other courts have specifically refused to go. The next thing that we believe merits de novo review is the court erred in determining what permits are necessary. Now, it would be a factual question as to, did you obtain permit X? Did you comply with condition one on your permit? But as to what is a necessary permit?
You're talking about a lot of things being de novo legal issues that sound to me like an intensive fact-based situation for each case. Where are you drawing the notion that these are legal questions from?
I think because finding...
I mean, what permits are necessary for a power plant is going to vary from state to state, county to county, type of power plant, right?
It seems, though, that when you're making the qualitative determination of what's necessary and what's not, that seems to be getting into the realm of a legal determination.
Why?
Because it's making a broader judgment of what is necessary, what tests are critical, There are factual questions in there, but like in Seeley...
Why is whether something's critical or not, isn't that going to be a fact-to-fact dependent issue? So you're talking about all these as de novo questions. Where in statute or case law does it set out a legal standard for us to determine what are four across the board, not fact-dependent, critical tests?
Well, what we've seen is the statement in the Seeley case. They found the court misapplied the factors, the legal standards, as to when a NASA is placed in service, so they went de novo. And we think this
That doesn't answer my question. You were talking about that whether or not certain tests are critical is a legal question. Is there anything in any statute or regulation that defines what's a critical test or not that we would have to interpret as a matter of law?
Not more than what I've stated, not that I know of.
Is there anything in case law that says here's a legal standard for determining what test is critical or not?
Nothing beyond Seeley. And if the court were...
But Seeley didn't say a legal test overall for determining what test. It's found as maybe as a matter of law there, the placed in service decision was wrong. But you're trying to go down another level to all these subsidiary factual questions. I just don't understand what law we're being asked to say that the trial court misinterpreted that we get a review de novo rather than looking at the law and saying, did the trial court make clearly erroneous factual findings?
I think that this court could also find that there was clear error on the determinations. If you disagree that there's de novo review in what's necessary.
Well, I don't understand what you're asking us to do when you say de novo review.
We think, let's talk about the permits. The trial court found that the only necessary permit was the authority to construct. An authority to construct gives the owner a right to construct a facility. And the court found that that's all that was required here. But the evidence was clear that these facilities could not comply with the conditions in this conditional permit. And in our view, where they're still constructing and not complying with conditions, they could not operate. That's not a permit at all. If you have a permit that's subject to conditions and you can't meet any of the conditions in your permit, you're not allowed to operate. That's flat-out illegal operations. And she elevated on the testing. She elevated the interconnection tests over the testing that were required in the ATCs and by the district, which was environmental testing.
Let's look at the statute. 1603 says that it's in lieu of production tax credits, and the government makes much of the fact that production tax credits were claimed, and they say that ends it. If you claim the tax credits, you aren't entitled to 1603. Is there an easy answer to that?
There is. A different taxpayer took those production tax credits in a prior year. CalBio took the PTCs, and Acada, who CalBio sold the facilities to, has never taken PTCs. The trial court properly found that CalBio, that the actions of a different taxpayer, CalBio, are not binding on Acada. Although they took production tax credits, Acada did not. And there's no evidence Acada ever took any PTCs, so it would not be disqualified. I think that is an easy answer. Two different taxpayers.
So a particular facility is eligible for competing tax credits that are internally inconsistent. I mean, the premise of your argument is that CalBio wasn't eligible for those credits, right?
Right. We think the IRS should have acted to recapture those tax credits. They didn't. But CalBio's actions don't disqualify the possibility of a 1603 grant going forward. Even by the statute, it's in the year they were taken, rather than once we've moved into the future past
that. To the extent that CalBio was eligible for those production credits, is there a different test that would have applied when they asked them, or was it the same kind of in-service test?
It would have been the same, basically the same place-in-service test. except Cal Bio made the determination they were placed in service back in 08.
And the IRS accepted that determination, apparently.
They didn't challenge it. We think they should have, but they did not. Let me jump back to the standard review real quick. If you go with clear error, you find all these are factual questions, it's still clear error. To find that a facility that is violating the Clean Air Act constantly, that can never comply with its obligations under the district permits and rules, and the sole function of that district is to limit air pollution, that didn't install the equipment that was required to be installed by the district under their permits, and that wound up getting sued by the state and federal government to shut down until they complied, can be placed in service at a time when they're operating so rampantly illegally as Cal Bio was prior to Acada coming on board.
One of the problems and difficulties I'm having with your argument is that when I look at the Treasury regulation defining placed in service and other sources of law for understanding what that means in the statute, it's not as rigid as what you're asking for here. You're asking for a more strict review of what is required when you say, you know, that there's clear error in finding that all it has to be is capable of generating electricity for sale. I don't see anything in the law that puts the kind of limitations on this that you're putting in with respect to having to comply with the Clean Air Act and such.
Well, the Clean Air Act itself...
I mean in terms of tax credit.
Okay.
Okay.
I guess what we would say is two things. One, no one's gone as far as this trial court did. You connect and you make some power, you're placed in service. That's been rejected by a number of decisions. And then when they do find place in service, the courts have put weight on what has the taxpayer done and not done. And these are all cited, so this is on shorthand. In Brown case, it wasn't placed in service until a conference table had been installed on an airplane. In Noel...
Isn't the dispute here between the parties about what is the specifically assigned function? Isn't that the key issue in the case?
That is very much one of the key issues in the case because the court found it was simply to produce and sell electricity, and no court has ever done that. The IRS has never done that. No one has ever taken that limited view of what place in service is.
Are you still pressing that there should be a line drawn between the entitlements of Chowchilla and Merced as to when they went into service?
There was a clear line between Chowchilla and Merced. There's no way to conclude that Merced was placed in service prior to 2009. It didn't even interconnect, even under the trial court's view of what's placed in service. It didn't interconnect until March 2009. So, yes, we think at a minimum the trial court should have awarded the grant for Merced.
But if we accept the trial court's reasoning and push it to 2009, it still went into operation in 2009.
Right.
Setting aside your other views, how do you claim for 2009 when you weren't the taxpayer in 2009?
Well, because the proper applicants under guidance and under 1603 are the disregarded entities, Chowchilla and Merced. They're the proper applicants. Per the guidance, the applicant is not the ultimate taxpayer. It only matters that the property qualifies. And this was specified energy property, and nothing ever happened to change that. The only thing that happened was that Cal Bio sold to Acada, but there's nothing in 1603 that precludes that. In fact, it allows you to assign your right to payment if you want to. Here, the use of the property didn't change. The transfer of the property was not to a user who was not qualified. And I think significantly, these facilities did get partial grants, and the parties agreed to this.
Let me ask you this. You said that the reason the prior credits didn't matter is because the current taxpayer wasn't the taxpayer then. Who got the credit? Were there credits given in 2009?
If there were, it would have been to Cal Bio because they still own the facility then.
Yeah, but they would have been, I mean, under your logic that the credits go back to who the, I, I'm not a tax lawyer. I don't remember that term you just used.
We think the credits should start in 2011.
No, I know, but let's just assume you've lost on that argument. We're now down to arguing about, and that you're out on Chowchilla, but we have a question about Merced in 2009 versus 2008. You said, what's the word, the ignored company? You have a
phrase. Oh, the disregarded entity.
Well, you said the tax credits, in terms of your argument, should go with the discredited entity.
Yeah,
that's why you can still gain them for 2009, but didn't the discredited entity get tax credits for 2009 already?
No, the ultimate taxpayer would have gotten those.
I don't understand the logic of ignoring it, the discredited entity, for purposes of you getting them, but not or ignoring it for purposes of the credits already given. They're all based on the same facility, aren't they?
Yes, and they're all based because it's the same applicants. And by the guidance in the statute, we look to the applicants. That's Chowchilla Merced. It doesn't matter who owns them. They own the facility, then they're the original user. They're still the owner user now.
So if it's the original facility we're looking at for purposes of the tax credit or grant, then Merced already got a credit for 2009.
Merced did not, because it went to CalBio.
Okay.
I better stop. I'm over.
Okay, thank you. We'll save your rebuttal time, and let's hear from the government. Mr. Carpenter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Clint Carpenter. I represent the United States in this case. Why don't I start with the production tax credit issue that came up sort of earlier and then again right
Can
at
you
end
pull
there.
Back, actually? I'm really confused about what we're even being asked to answer here and what the standards of review are and whether the Seeley case applies and how it applies. Does the government agree Seeley is the applicable test here? Certainly the Fifth Circuit has adopted it. We haven't adopted it yet, and we get some tax cases. So do you think we should adopt it for purposes of our law?
Yes, I think that's appropriate. In terms of the test, the five factors, they're non-exclusive factors, but in terms of sort of guidance and focusing on whether the facilities were operational, absolutely, yes.
So then your friend wants to argue that the intended purpose of the facility is a legal question. I'm a little bit baffled as how that is a legal question, and if it is, what the legal test is for us to review that is. Do you think it's a legal question or do you think it's a factual question?
No, we think it's a factual question. It's a question of fact as to what the purpose of the facility was. And in fact, in 2008, the owners of the facility treated its purpose as being just what the claims court found. That with its purpose was to generate and sell electricity in commercial quantities. And CalBio, they treated it that as the purpose because they claimed production tax credits that were premised on that.
So here's my issue is there's got to be some kind of line somewhere about the intended purpose and a changeover from pre-operational testing where you may be doing some of this stuff and may even be able to sell it on the market at a minimal level and operating at its intended purpose. And I don't want to use words like full production or anything like that because it doesn't seem like that's in any of your regulations or the statute. It's a very amorphous line. But is there some way that we have that's kind of an objective way to look at when it's operating for its intended purpose and not testing, or is it really just going to be a case-by-case basis?
I think it's largely case-by-case. It's a fact-intensive issue for the finder of fact to determine based on all the evidence. There could be cases where, and there have been cases, where there was the court sort of felt that it fell short of the line because of testing that still needed to be completed, and then there's other cases where the court found that that was okay, and there's a lot of factors going into play here.
So if we get there, why? Because it does seem like there was an awful lot of testing that still needed to be done here and a lot of things to be, even equipment to be provided before it was actually compliant with all the state and local and federal regulations. Why wasn't it clear error to find that this had met sufficient testing requirements?
Well, because the issue isn't environmental compliance. The issue is whether it was placed in service. The court found, based on expert testimony and other evidence in the record, that...
Okay, I understand. This is where I get a little kind of caught up. Sure. It seems this argument's a little bit circular to me, because at least if testing is one of the sealing factors, then I assume the point of that is to demarcate some kind of line between kind of, you know, just a testing phase and operational phase. And so how do we determine, when there's still a lot of testing to be done, what testing is not required before you go into the operational phase, and what, you know, testing is sufficient and what can be done later? I'm sorry, that was a little convoluted itself, but I hope you got that.
I think I did. I think you have to look to sort of what's the broader purpose of the test. These are factors that are intended to sort of illuminate this bigger concept of place and service. If you look at the regulations, the overarching factor, you know, the recurring theme in each subsection of the regulations is whether the facility is operational. So I think you can look at testing in terms of, well, was more testing required before the facility could operate, or was it not? And if this were a case where more testing was required before the facility could operate, then that might be a situation where you would say, well, it wasn't placed in service. But the evidence here shows that the facility was fully operating with the knowledge and consent of the regulators before it finished that testing. In fact, that was the California regulator's sort of preferred approach. They recognize that these types of facilities in particular have difficulties with Clean Air Act compliance and things like that.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Suppose, and I know this is not based in the facts, but suppose California had a rule that for these types of facilities, they want them to be up and running for 2 weeks at whatever capacity they can muster before they allow them to engage in commercial operations. But that electricity can somehow be stored and sold. So if they're allowed to just open up for that 2 week period and they run it and they produce an amount of electricity that has a value and gets sold, but that's still just this initial 2 week test, would that be qualifying as in service under this regulation?
Well, I think that would at least be a lot closer question.
What about factor five, which is daily or regular operation has begun? Wouldn't 2 weeks not be daily or regular operation under Oglethorpe and Sealy?
Yes, no, I think that's if it's 2 weeks and then you failed the testing and so you have to shut down. If that were the law in California, then yes, you would probably fail the operational the daily operation factor as well.
I'm going to a different point for a minute, but are you in Sealy, one of the components one of the factors with respect to permits and licenses is not whether you're complying with them, but it's whether the permits and licenses for operation have been obtained. Wasn't that satisfied here?
Yes, and it was satisfied here. They had the authority to construct permit, which I recognize it sounds like it just is giving you permission to construct, but that isn't in fact what it gives permission to do. And the claims court found, and I don't think there's really any dispute, that it authorized facilities to begin generating and selling electricity in addition to constructing the facilities. Eventually, that permit could be transformed into a different permit, permit to operate, I believe, or something like that. But the facilities could operate in the meantime under their authority to construct, and that's how it works in California, as the claims court found. So, yes, they had all the permits that were necessary to operate. I think it's important to remember that this is not a case, even like Sealy, where it was a really small amount of electricity that was generated. And certainly, you know, there could be some disagreement over whether it was enough in Sealy. But in this case, you know, we're talking about, you know, they generate enough electricity to power about 5,800 homes for a year in California. This was a little less than half of the maximum power that facilities were even rated to generate during that time period. So they were operating at a high capacity, generating a lot of electricity and selling it for millions of dollars. So this wasn't sort of a de minimis generation situation. So, as far as the standard of review, in our view, it's clear error. These are issues of fact.
Could you address the Merced facility particularly and the questions we were, because there is some, and you addressed it in your brief too, but I know the trial court found that it was sufficiently operational in 2008 to place it there, but there is a key factor, and I forget what, but something happened in 2009 that makes it a little bit fuzzier of a question.
Yeah, the one difference that with Merced was that it wasn't until February 2009 that Merced achieved its commercial operation date under the interconnection agreements with PG&E, which is sort of a technical requirement. Before, you can sell electricity before that, but you're not selling it under the agreement to PG&E at the specified rates under the agreement. So they didn't achieve that until February 2009. However, in the process of sort of negotiating that with PG&E, it was agreed that the basis for that commercial operation date would be based on their Merced's generation in the third and fourth quarters of 2008. So essentially, they qualified for the commercial operation date in 2008. But they didn't, you know, it wasn't signed off on until 2009. In terms of what actually occurred at the facilities, it was the same. They were generating as much as they possibly could, as often as they possibly could, for essentially from the date they started running in 2008, which was in August, through the end of the year. And it continued into 2009. Yeah, I think in terms of the environmental issues, again, the non-compliance, they were, in fact, allowed to operate despite this non-compliance. They sold millions of dollars of electricity during that time. The regulators who were charged with enforcing the environmental policies were okay with that and allowed it to continue until later on. They eventually there was the consent decree and so forth. The trial court didn't clearly err in finding facilities were placed in service in 2008. They were operating. They had the permits to do so. The pre-operational testing was completed, and the other two factors are it's conceded that.
What about your friend's argument that no court ever has set such a low burden for in-service as just generating and selling electricity?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's correct. I think that was what the standard was in Seeley. Certainly, courts have said, you know, they've looked to the other factors, and it's not just a factor of did you generate or sell any amount of electricity. You know, my friend on the other side has sort of said that's what the trial court did here, but that's not correct. Again, this wasn't just a de minimis amount of electricity. This wasn't sort of a 2 week. We turned it on for 2 weeks and then we shut down. We're running full bore. In fact, the Chowchilla was restarted in April 2008. Merced was restarted in July 2008, and it wasn't until a month later when CalBio started treating them as being in quote unquote in operation. So there was this sort of month beforehand between when they restarted the facilities and when the owners treated them as sort of running full power.
Let's go back a little bit. I'm still troubled by this tax credit issue. I know the government says that because they obtained tax credits, that's evidence that the plant was in service, even though it wasn't certified and it had all sorts of problems. But what about the corollary of that? If tax credits were not obtained. It's clear that the plants were not fully certified for use, that they had all sorts of problems. How much, in trying to figure out where the line should be drawn, how much weight should be given to whether they did or didn't obtain tax credits?
I think the tax credits, it's a piece of evidence on the placed in service date, because it shows that what the owners at the time believed, that it was placed in service in 2008 because they claimed the credits. You can't claim the credits if it hasn't been placed in service. And so it's a little bit of evidence in terms of the placed in service date. Just it shows that their owners at the time believed that it was placed in service in 2008 and claimed credits accordingly. The credits also separate from that. The court can avoid getting into the whole factual issue because the credits also separately under the statutes preclude any claim for Section 1603 grants. If a facility has received, if production tax credits have been received for a facility previously, then the facility is not eligible at all for Section 1603 grants. And so our position is that because the facilities received production tax credits in 2008, that as a result of that, they are not qualified property under Section 48, and in turn, they're not specified energy property under Section 1603. So these are sort of definitional issues. But for a facility to qualify for a Section 1603 grant, it has to be a certain type of property under Section 48. And to be that certain type of property, it cannot have received, their production tax credits cannot have been allowed for that facility. In this case, they had been allowed, and so that precludes any Section 1603 grant.
Just to clarify, the Court of Federal Claims decision below really does not rely on that.
That's correct.
Its main holding.
That's
right?
Correct. Yes. On that issue, the court seemed to reject our position, although it didn't really directly address it, but it certainly did not rely on it. That's right.
Right. So in response to Judge Newman's question about how important it is, at least to the court below, it wasn't important at all, right?
That's right. I don't think the court relied on it at all. That's correct.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Any more questions, Mr. Carpenter? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Leatham, of your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try to hit this quickly. This is really coming down to a case of legality and environmental considerations versus production. The trial court below just rejected environmental considerations. Environmental testing doesn't matter. Pollution control equipment doesn't matter. All that matters is that you produce. And we think that's clearer.
Didn't California also reject environmental considerations by allowing this facility to operate and sell electricity on the commercial market without compliance?
What they did was allow Chowchilla to have a variance so that they could continue testing, which was going to result in some exceedances while testing. But if you generate power, it's got to go somewhere, and it gets sold. But they did not go along with it.
Well, let's just assume this isn't just power produced for purpose of testing. This was a lot more power at a large dollar volume. I know it's not huge, but it's not does not seem to be the de minimis type of testing that wouldn't qualify as in service.
Yeah, and we don't argue that it was that type of de minimis. What we argue is that the environmental considerations are just as important. It's a non-attainment district where pollution is a problem and it needs to be prevented. And these things should not have been operating, as the district said in its letter.
But that
and as
does, EPA I don't and the understand district how said, that so has anything to do with the tax law and the tax credits. If the federal or the California EPA had wanted to shut these facilities down, they could have, but they didn't do it.
Well, they did sue them and get consent decrees.
Yeah, but later, after they'd already been in service producing electricity that was sold on the commercial market.
They made the decision to try to let them, to accommodate them and try to let them get there.
So why isn't the environmental question just independent of whether they were producing electricity? Why is there anything in the tax statute that says you only qualify for credits if you're in service in compliance with environmental regulations?
Because the Clean Air Act itself disqualifies violators from receiving federal benefits. you have to be in compliance with the Clean Air Act or you can't get federal grants, contracts, et cetera. That's in the Clean Air Act itself. They shouldn't have been entitled to get anything back.
Well, that seems like something that's the government's, you know, right to assert, not your right to assert as some kind of, you know, circuitous way to get a grant after the fact.
But they did finally. They sued to either comply with these environmental requirements or get shut down and got fined hundreds of thousands of dollars. Quickly, production tax credits, Your Honor, that would preclude the grant. They can't be taken in the year the grant is obtained. Here they tried to get the grant in 2011. PTCs were back in 2008. It does not disqualify them in future years. So in addition to them being separate taxpayers. And lastly, the IRS, remember, did not acquiesce in Sealy and found that production has to be sustained, reliable, and in commercial quality.
It sounds like they acquiesced here today, though.
That's a good point. They tend to acquiesce whenever it's against the taxpayer's best interest.
Well, I mean, sometimes Sealy is in the taxpayer's interest and not the government's interest. I heard them say today that they thought it was okay for us to adopt Sealy as Federal Circuit precedent.
Right.
And perhaps if they didn't mean that, they should tell us that.
I agree that the positions taken by the government in these cases are very interesting because they are always anti-taxpayer. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any more questions?
I don't know if you have other questions.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.